Well, what a week this has been in Australian politics, really a fortnight, starting with the comments from Alan Jones, referring to the Prime Minister's late father, to the motion to remove Peter Slipper from the Speaker of the House, to his resignation. It's been an extraordinary spectacle, with plenty of instant, subjective commentary, but also, I suspect, a slower, more subconscious reflection by a lot of us about what it all really means, probably over this weekend. It certainly exemplified that idea of democracy embodying all the unsolved debates of the culture that it sits amidst. But while it was certainly high emotion, and the adrenaline junkies might have adored it, and are pleading for more, please, a lot of others of us will be pleading for a resumption of more presumed civility, not a bromide applied to things, but certainly less strident. I saw the veteran contributor Wendy McCarthy yesterday in the Financial Review calling for a return to political correctness, a return to some respect. So what might be the rules of engagement, if you like, in a democracy with all its social media, where freedom of speech is upheld, but where the conventions of restraint must surely apply about what you can and can't say publicly? And maybe this needs to be reviewed from time to time. Why wouldn't it be in some ways? Yesterday on Breakfast, Radio National Breakfast, the new Speaker of the House, Anna Burke, explained why she thought Parliament had become quite so rowdy.
Rigorous debate's great. Just don't be personal. Just don't be vitriolic.
Do you think standards have got worse?
I think they have deteriorated over the years, and I certainly think this Parliament has been worse.
Why do you think that is?
Because of the nature of the Parliament, because of the nature of the hung Parliament, that every day there could be an election.
Well, we'll check that with the two prominent observers of Australian politics now and in the past, George Megalogenis. He's the respected political commentator and columnist for The Australian. And Judith Brett is Professor of Politics at La Trobe University and the author of several acclaimed books about Australian politics, often using, as she puts it, a psychoanalytic approach, which always mean they offer something extra. Thank you both for joining me to mull over these quite complex issues.
Good morning.
Thank you.
George Megalogenis, to you first. If you look over the years, what have been the lowest points in Parliament for you? I mean, how does this week compare? That's what I'm really trying to tease out from you.
Well, this week has a couple of sort of joint record holders from this term, and there was the one when they couldn't get an agreement on asylum seekers a couple of months ago, and certainly when that week when Craig Thompson decided to finally explain himself, that was a painful, that thing itself was painful viewing. And then for the next couple of days, culminating in Tony Abbott and Christopher Pyne making a dash for the door because they didn't want to sit on the same side of the benches as Craig Thompson, I think that one sticks out, as does the asylum seeker standoff, where people wanted to have a debate about principle, a passionate debate, but at the end of the day, the numbers were so predictably partisan, if I can put it that way. There's about three or four episodes, I think, in the life of this Parliament that remind you how stupid both sides can be. But in the past, of course, we've had, and this is before my corporate memory as a working journalist, but certainly as a child, I distinctly remember that year, 1975, that, you know, you've got premiers trying to rig the numbers in the Senate after the fact by sending non-Labor people to fill casual vacancies from either retiring or departed Labor senators. You've got a whole other story going on around the corner, whether the Governor-General will not intervene in the hostage situation with the Bill Hayden budget. And then eventually an election gets called, but before the day the election is called and the government is sacked, there's a near riot on the steps of the old Parliament House. So it's not the first time we've been there, but the thing that always strikes me about this particular term of Parliament is the headline figures for the Australian economy have never been better. 1975, you can explain that brain snap because it was part of the West was having a collective brain snap in those days. Watergate, oil shock and a few other things were unsettling sort of the Western mind. I know coming out of the GFC, there are a number of reasons why, say, an Australian population might be unsettled about the future, but you wouldn't say that Australia is in a bad position today. And in fact, that's why I think the disconnect between the community and the people elected to serve it has probably never been wider.
So, Judith Brett, how would you answer that question when you look into your history books?
Well, I think passions have often run high in the Parliament. in 1909, when the Liberal Party was formed out of the fusion of a Conservative and a Liberal Party, there was huge anger in the House, and there was a sort of riotous atmosphere in which the Speaker had a heart attack. He was carried saying, "Dreadful, dreadful," were his last words.
Oh, dear.
So, I mean, I think what's shifted is what the passions are running high about. Similarly, Menzies was attacked very nastily by Earl Page for failing to enlist in World War I. Now, at the time, that was a really damning criticism, and it ruined Page's subsequent political career. So I don't think there's anything new in some ways in the height of the passion or in the quite personal attacks we're seeing. What's different, I think, is that there's a woman in the Prime Minister's chair.
Really? So it turns on a new, almost like a theoretically new discourse entering proceedings?
Well, I think Parliament was, in a sense, you know, in the way we understand it now, grew out of the sort of pacification of politics, such that men stopped fighting with swords and started fighting with words. You know, the differences would be settled in the chamber through elaborate rules and rituals. And it's always been, I think, a sort of a theatre for the management of male aggression. And I think that the presence of women in the chamber destabilises a lot of that. And I think that, combined with the fact, you know, so Julia's Prime Minister and she's the Prime Minister in a minority government. And minority governments we haven't seen very much of. And I think Anna Burke's quite right to point to that as a significant element in what we're seeing here. But I think the combination of these, where power seems to Abbott and to the other side so close, it's so tantalising, and there's a woman in the top job.
Certainly, George, it just seems to me the key question to come out of, one of the key questions is, when have things gone too far, and I suppose the sort of the subordinate clause is, for the good operation of democracy?
Well, I can tell you things haven't gone too far in this term, in so much as this parliament had actually been a little better than the previous parliament, the majority parliament that Kevin Rudd ruled over. For those first 2 years of that government, he had near record approval ratings, and no one questioned his authority, but not much got done because there was a very big entree on the Prime Minister's desk in those days. This parliament has actually, in a transactional sense, achieved a little more than the previous parliament did. I don't think that that's the issue. The question of when things go too far, it's when politicians in the heat of the moment start talking to one another in the way that they know is embarrassing the country, but they can't stop themselves. And I think we've had three moments this year. The ones I mentioned earlier, the Craig Thompson week, the Asylum Seeker week, and this week. There are 3 weeks, and they're quite a number of sitting days taken up by those three events, where the participants know that the people have tuned out. Not only are the people tuned out, that they know as soon as they go back to their electorates, they're going to get an aggressive pushback from their own constituents. And politicians tend to go back to work about a week after, or whenever the parliament resits after one of these episodes, and they do go through this sort of ritual of attempting to talk the country up again, and then they slip back into it. But I guess what I'm interested in is why the temperature, well, the mercury basically bursts through the thermometer as it did this week, as it did in the Asylum Seeker week, and as it did in the Craig Thompson week. And you'd probably think it's because one side chose to push the government to the brink, and the government either withheld, either held back, or in this instance, Julia Gillard said, well, you're trying to push us. You've got us up against the wall. I can feel your hand on my throat. By the way, I'm going to tell you to get lost. And that was the difference this week. She pretty much snapped that conversation by creating a totally different one.
Well, I suppose I think it was the interplay between Parliament and the broader conversation, seems to me. So that the Alan Jones comments were obviously a massive backdrop, I think. And this is where I think the press galleries missed something, that there is an interplay. And it was almost, in my judgment, that it gave her sort of permission. Well, I would argue that a lot of women need this, to almost go into bat on behalf of something else greater than just your own political survival or yourself. I wonder whether you agree with that, Judith, whether that's the different part of the different political discourse introduced by women.
It seemed to me that she's been amazingly forbearing. I mean, she didn't say anything when there was that appalling At Home with Julia television show going. You know, she's put up with a hell of a lot, and then finally they attacked her dead father. Now, I think this was, you know, like a point at which it would have given her the emotional impetus, grief turned to anger in some ways, that you could see coming through that amazingly controlled performance that she gave the other night. I mean, that I thought was electrifying. But there was an emotion there that was fueling that I think was because, well, they were both trespassing on her grief, but they were also insulting her father. I mean, Alan Jones called him the old man. He didn't even give him a name.
Mm.
And he insulted the man's pride in his daughter. I mean, it was... And it seemed to me that moved beyond the highly politicised area of sexual behaviour and gender relations into the area of death and mourning. And this was breaching, I think, quite sacred private experiences of people. And I think that's a big difference between some of the earlier stuff and behind the sort of very widespread real repulsion that people have of what she's had to put up with.
I suppose that's what intrigues me, George, is how we might move back from this uncivil atmosphere to something more, which means almost going over the codes or devising new ones that might work. And I wonder if Judith is right. Death becomes beyond the pale. Similarly, Belinda Neal talking about Sophie Mirabella's unborn baby, as she did a couple of years ago, as wishing it ill that it be born poorly or something, which is quite extraordinary to think of a woman saying that to another woman. So that's sort of, again, another aspect of the life cycle. I would have thought suicide is another thing that is beyond the pale. And maybe you're referring notions of cowardice that you're talking about, Earl Page. And I mean, do you ponder what might be the new conventions while we've got this hung parliament where you simply don't go?
I don't know. I think these conventions are developed on a case-by-case basis. There's a gut response, and you almost know at the minute it's tumbled out of your mouth when you've said the wrong thing. You may then run around, your side of politics may then try to run around and look for an equivalent outrage from the other side. What I've noticed, for example, in this particular case, the coalition are running around looking for equivalent cases of sexism. I mean, good luck on that search, because you won't find an equivalent example where the Prime Minister of the country, as Judith points out, had her private grief intruded upon by somebody essentially trying to politicise something that private. The fact that the climate permitted an Alan Jones type character to think that this thing was fair sport probably tells you about the extent to which Julia Gillard maybe allowed that boundary to be pushed a little too far out at her expense.
She should have said something earlier, possibly, you're thinking.
Yeah, but the problem, and she's obviously taken this decision, politics is a tough game and there are no rewards for the person who complains. But of course, look, in a sense, the trigger this week was that Tony Abbott, whether it was conscious or unconscious, used
repeated
the line dying of shame.
Yeah.
And look, if you're a political strategist, you'd have said to Tony Abbott on the Tuesday, look, Peter Slipp has probably got hours to go as the Speaker. Zip your lip and let it happen, and then claim the win at the end of the day. But of course, they wanted to push. But the funny thing is, it was all upside for them on the Peter Slipper matter, and this is why the press gallery is sort of getting hounded about the context. But the context, of course, changed completely because Julia Gillard was given permission to have that other conversation that every woman in Australia has had in her head pretty much all her life, in the workplace or if she's been propositioned at a bar. It's usually in the taxi cab on the way home from work, or on the train or the tram on the way home from work, that the zinger comes, and you'd wished you'd thought of it, you'd wished you'd been able to say it to this bloke, but you never did. And of course, what Julia Gillard did was not only called it out, she called Tony Abbott out, but she was calling it out, but she called it out from a position of strength. I mean, she was actually acting a position as a leader. So calling it out on behalf of women generally was, you've probably never been able to script a moment quite like it.
And finally, back to you, Judith. Laura Tingle has a column in Financial Review advising that there was genuine concerns about possible life-threatening issues, suicide issues. Clearly she's referring, if I read her correctly, to Peter Slipper. And nobody could forget Nick Sherry. And I know that Peter Costello had a lot of worries about things that he might have contributed in the sort of, quotes, robust environment of the time. I mean, I just again wonder whether everybody needs to take a chill pill and work out what principles do you apply to be both robust and civil?
Well, I mean, in the old days, people said it should be measures, not men. That is, you attack people's policies, but that you don't attack them personally. And that was the sort of the rule that people used to try to pull back. But we're in a situation now where with the sort of shock jocks and social media providing a background, I mean, Andrew Bolt has written in Sun Herald, "Power is Julia Gillard's true passion as she plays the gender card, victim card, and her father's death to advantage." So this is not stopping. You know, it's just going on.
It's like the crack cocaine, as Robert Hughes said, of politics. When you start trading these sorts of insults, that's what I think really worrying. Look, George Megalogenis and Judith Brett, this is a conversation that will go on all through the weekend and around loads of coffees and drinks. Thanks so much indeed for joining us today on Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
Thank you.
George Megalogenis, a political commentator and columnist for The Australian. His latest book, The Australian Moment, How We Were Made for These Times. It's published by Penguin. And Judith Brett is Professor of Politics at La Trobe University, the author of several books. Her latest is a quarterly essay, Fair Share, Country and City in Australia. It was published last year by Black Ink. And I very much welcome your responses. In fact, I really would be delighted to hear the range of responses from Saturday Extra listeners to this remarkable fortnight in Australian life, and just to see how you're thinking. So abc.net.au/rn/Saturday Extra, and you can leave your thoughts, or you can write to us, or you can tweet me at Geraldine Duke.